Buddhist Summer School, Wednesday afternoon, 2nd September 1981. There are three questions here, and I'm not at all sure whether I'm competent to deal with them. But I'll try. The first question is as follows. Why does the perfect, the total, and the uncreated need to create? At the human level, the motivation for our actions is our incompleteness. We eat because we are hungry. If food was within me, I would not need to eat. Even at more creative levels, is incompleteness not the urge that drives a Beethoven to write a symphony? What urges transcendence to give rise to a manifested cosmos? Now, if anybody can give the perfect answer to that, he'd be the perfected Holy One himself. Why does the perfect, the total, the uncreated need to create? Forgive me for saying it, but I think the question could be worded in a better form. The primordial creative energy has no need to create, because it is the nature of that primordial creative energy to be continuously creative without a stop. It's creative action in eternity. There is no question of why. When we ask a question, why do you want, such as, why do you want to do this? We are inquiring for the motive of that person. Now, we cannot transpose our condition and our state to the transcendent at all. We are finite, temporal, and mortal. We have whys and wherefores and all the rest of it. Transcendence has absolutely nothing like that. A why implies also a relationship between this and that. But in totality, in the infinite, what relationship is there? There is no such thing as a relationship in the infinite or in eternity. So the question is not very happily worded, if I may be allowed to say so. It just creates, that's all. That's how it is. There's an absolute isness about it. Istigkeit. Is that correct German?
Yes.
You see? That's why creation comes into being. Now, in India, philosophers have put forward certain ideas in this connection. They have said that Brahman, that is the Absolute, needing to know himself, brought forth the other, and that is creation, the created cosmos. Brought forth that through which he comes to know himself. You may remember, I myself have said time and again that it is transcendence which comes to fulfillment through us as man. Transcendence comes to fulfillment through the perfect tree or the perfect flower as the perfect tree and the perfect flower. Well, that is a sort of an answer to why. Um, But really, one can't ask such questions with respect to the transcendent. The context is so other than the context of the finite, the temporal and the mortal, that everything which has meaning in this limited context loses its meaning in the other context. To give just one example of that, there is no such thing as purpose where the infinite or the eternal is concerned. It cannot have a purpose. A purpose comes into being by virtue of the relationship of this to that. Then a purpose can come into being. Where there is separateness, there can be purpose. But where there is only the absolute, the infinite and the eternal, there can be no purpose. These are all projections into the infinite of our human limitations and difficulties. The sensible thing is to live the religious life in fullness and thereby arrive at that state of purity and perfection because of which one can enter into that supreme meditative state which is the perfect communion with the two contexts, the finite and the infinite, become one context. And you realize that in your own inner consciousness, and through you the transcendent context finds its fulfillment. Then the purpose of our existence is fulfilled. You see, this restoration of the imperfect back to perfection. The question goes on, at the human level, the motivation for our action is our incompleteness. We eat because we are hungry. If food was within us, we would not need to eat. Well, that is one aspect only of it. The sense of incompleteness that we have motivates our actions. But there are so many other motivating forces for our actions. Parents have children. It is perfectly natural for parents to look after the children, to tend them, to bring them up. Or take another example. You have a gift as a gardener. All right, you have a garden, and you tend that garden. It is not in order that your incompleteness may be fulfilled. You are not incomplete at all. But because you have this gift and you love gardening and gardens and the beauty of the plant world and so forth, you tend the garden, and that's that. Even at more creative levels, is incompleteness not the urge that drives a Beethoven to write a symphony? Beethoven isn't a very good example here. He was very positive. He knew he was a genius. He was well aware of it. And this inner gift inside him, this power to pour forth music, was so great that naturally he poured forth music. There is this element. You know, one of the outstanding characteristic of Beethoven's work is that he wrote 9 symphonies. But each symphony is something quite unique and in advance of the previous symphonies. That is the extraordinary thing about him altogether. There is no repetitiveness apart from the use of the rules of music, harmony and counterpoint, and the actual construction, the sonata form or the symphonic form or the quartet and so forth and so forth, apart from that. But it's a sort of a new universe which comes into being with a new composition of Beethoven. In Mozart, that perfect craftsman where music is concerned, also possessing great depth and a wonderful flow of pure music, you find a lot of repetition. You can expect, now it will go like this and now it will go like that. You see? You always get that same, for instance, in his piano sonatas, you get that same run upwards to the chord of the sixth, which means that from there onwards it will come to the end of the exposition as such, you see. It's the same thing always. In every single work of his you'll find that. Now, you look at the corresponding thing in Beethoven's work. All his, it's a tremendously different type of development. The Waldstein Sonata, first movement towards the end, is a wonderful example of that. Whereas Mozart will finish it off after about six or eight bars. Beethoven spends two whole pages of wonderful stuff finishing that first movement of the Waldstein. It's like that, you see. Well, the creative urge is there and it just fulfills itself. You can, of course, regard it as due to a sense of a sense of incompleteness within one. What urges transcendence to give rise to a manifested cosmos? I think I'll tell you a little story in answer to this. Two Christian priests were talking about the deep things, and in the course of their talk, one started asking this question: why did God? And the other person immediately interrupted him and answered, "God knows." Now, we come to the second question. The cause of our suffering is the veil of ignorance, the avidya. Where does avidya, which is an imperfection, an evil, come from? If the reality is the perfect and the total, how can avidya arise from it? Do we need to invent a devil separate from a perfect and all-encompassing reality, and within brackets, a contradiction that injects avidya into the system? Now look. Avidya is the absence of vidya. It is the non-existence of vidya. How can non-being come out of come into the situation? You see, avidya, ignorance, it doesn't come from anywhere. We start like that. That is the starting point, so to say, as far as we are concerned. Look at a baby, newborn child. It's born in a state of considerable ignorance, not so much ignorance as we formerly used to imagine. But there is a considerable amount of ignorance to start with. And then as the days pass and the baby grows, it gathers information, knowledge, it gathers techniques and so forth. And so the ignorant state gives place to the knowing state. But avidya doesn't come from anywhere, as far as I'm aware. If the reality is the perfect and the total, how can avidya arise from it? No, avidya doesn't arise from the perfect, the total, but it is somehow contained within it, insofar as in the process of creative activity, when something new begins, then it begins in a state where it is not aware of the whole truth. You can't avoid that. Do we need to invent a devil separate from a perfect and all-encompassing reality? No, we don't need to invent a devil at all who injects avidya into the system. You know, in the Zarathustrian scriptures, there is the presentation of man being created with a dual mind. One part of that mind is the ill mind, the evil mind. The other part is the good mind. Man has both these inside him. And man is left entirely free to choose for himself whether he'll follow the vahu mano, the good mind, the perfect mind. Vahu is the avastan equivalent of the Pali sama, perfect. Whether he'll follow that, the perfect mind, or whether he'll follow the akhem mano, the klishta manas, the defiled mind. You see, he's left entirely free. Now, this is one of the unique features in Zarathustrian teaching, that man is left entirely free to choose. He's got this mind which is dualistic by nature, and he has to make the choice and go ahead with it. And this has been misinterpreted by many scholars, and they have said that Zarathustrianism is definitely a dualistic religion. They associate the akhem mano, the evil mind, with the devil as such, you see, and that they are, that Ahura Mazda, the creator, and Ahriman existed together side by side from the very beginning. This is a peculiar misinterpretation of what Zarathustra actually taught. So I don't feel that we can say that do we need to invent a devil separate from a perfect and all-encompassing reality. If we were born absolutely perfect all along, well, there's nothing to do. It would be something like a static world. There'd be no such thing as growth, as development, as fruition. It would leave no room for flexibility, for elasticity, for experimentation, and so on. And for chance and accident, which both have their place in the scheme of things. You know very well that if you had, say, 1,000 tons of coins, let us make it 1,000 pounds weight of coins, and you were to shuffle them thoroughly and throw them up and let them fall, the chances are there'll be approximately 500 heads and 500 tails up, you see. And the laws we have learnt our laws of chance and probability mathematically, and they work. Therefore, there is an element like chance in our life. And there is also the element of accident in one's life. It is not a rigid law of causation or a rigid law of karma operating there. Then the third question is, karma, the law of laws, is the law of healing and the restoration of harmony. The law of the physical world is that of entropy, meaning a perpetual working down of energy to a dead level. And when that happens, the universe is supposed to be dead. Lord Kelvin, I think, was responsible in the last century for developing that aspect of physics which deals with that, and he predicted that the sun was likely to last another 10,000 years. I think that is a little bit too short. Some of you may live to see that 10,000 years and may you live happily and without fear of the sun fading away and we being completely deprived of heat and light and life and so forth. There is the manifestation of entropy in the universal process, but I think that more recent scientific research shows there is a recreating process going on also. And that is why scientists say that there is no such thing as dead matter. This is particularly due to the school of Geoffrey Chou and Fritjof Capra. Geoffrey Chou is the architect of these ideas, what he calls the S-matrix theory. Or sometimes it's called the bootstrap theory. These are terms which are used. Briefly, their discovery physics of the, especially the physics of the subatomic realm, shows that any of these subatomic particles is not just a dead thing, a static thing. It perpetually throws out what they call a virtual particle and immediately reabsorbs it at the leisurely rate of 10 to the 23 times per second. That is 100,000,000,000,000,000 times a second. Now, you try and quake or quiver 100,000,000,000,000,000 times a second and see what it feels like. And so they say that all matter is alive all the time. It's really fascinating, absolutely wonderful to read what modern science is discovering. And you will see that it is coming in so many ways, so very close to the pronouncements in both Upanishadic and in Buddhist philosophic terms about the nature of things, the nature of material reality. The word material today has no meaning whatsoever, really speaking, because science has gone so far now with the interconvertibility of energy and mass. Mass meaning, of course, these solid, liquid and gaseous things that we see. And they are so completely interconvertible that it's no good saying that this is matter and that is this is material and that is immaterial. You can't draw the line. And similarly, one can't draw the line between what we call mind and body. They are actually an identity. But this identity we accept, if we do accept it, is a mere thought, a mere string of words, but you can get conscious of it. That is the extraordinary thing. Just as science, by scientific means, has discovered it as a fact. So, The law of the physical world is that of entropy. That is true, up to a point. How are these two reconciled, especially in view of your inspiring assertion that there is no dead matter? I don't know how to present a reconciliation, but for me there is nothing to reconcile, actually. The universal process will just go on. They say that the Big Bang started off the cosmos about 20,000 million years ago, and they predict vast periods of time for the cosmos as such still to come. But what may happen ultimately, these are matters of scientific conjecture. The whole cosmos may become one black hole. You know what a black hole is. All the matter of the universe collapses on itself. It collapses on itself and is crammed into an extremely small space. You remember I mentioned the other day that all the matter which we now see in the universe, just at the time of the Big Bang, was concentrated in a single point. Now, I called it archetypal matter. You remember? Mind is an archetypal form, and this is archetypal matter. In the Sankhya philosophy of India of 27 centuries ago, they talked of Prakruti and Purusha. Prakruti as archetypal nature, as primordial nature, and Purusha as this creative spirit which starts the Prakruti into activity by sheer presence. It's an extraordinary thing. Purusha is pure consciousness, absolute consciousness. And therefore it is that type of energy which, acting upon this primordial matter, started off the universal process. It's a very interesting philosophy, not very clearly understood or expounded. Kapila was the holy one who produced that. And we have the same sort of thing in the Kabbalah. The differentiations of the of Ein Sof, the infinite, from which emanated first Chokhmah, wisdom, and then Bina. Chokhmah is masculine, remember, in the Kabbalah. Wisdom is not feminine in the Kabbalah. And Bina, intelligence, which contains within itself all the positive and negative, the male and the female elements in interplay. But Chokhmah, by virtue of presence only, inspires Bina to start up into activity, and the universe emerges from that. That is how the Kabbalah presented it. And it's very interesting, the whole thing. And the way modern science is presenting these things is, in a way, enabling us to understand these things and be able to present concepts and a verbal formulation of these concepts, which shows us that there is this one reality, this one universal process going on. I must thank the questioner for these very difficult questions, and I am not at all certain that they have been adequately dealt with. Now we have another one here. If we manage to knock down all the cards in the circle of becoming, you remember I mentioned it yesterday, and stop craving, grasping, etc., how do we move through our lives? Do we stop making decisions, plans, having aims? Do we live hour by hour, minute by minute? If you touch the right nidana, tanha, craving, you will find that the entire, that all the factors which make up this paticca samuppada will find solution. They will all disappear. If you can really deal with tanha as such. And if you do that, you will find that there will be no need to make decisions or plans or have aims in the manner in which we, as we are at present, make decisions, plans, and have aims. That is the point. You see, when you have realized the state of liberation, what have you realized? The Buddha put it in these terms: the holy life, the brahmacharya, is to be lived not for honors, gains, this, that, and the other, but the goal of the holy life, the culmination of the holy life, is unconditional freedom of mind. That unconditional freedom of mind means that the archetypal energy, which is pure mind and which is characterless, is now functioning freely through your psyche, which is utterly purified. It's pure, it's empty of your particular conceptions, desires, ambitions, and all the rest of it. And therefore it is transparent to the light of transcendence itself. Now, that will happen, and in your inner consciousness, you will live nirvanically. Nirvana will manifest itself in your inner consciousness and through you. True enough. But everyday life, as long as the psychophysical organism is alive, will present situations, problems, and so forth, which will require decisions, plans, and having a particular aim within the limited context of the finite and the temporal in which we live. But your decisions and plans will be of such a nature that they will not harm and hurt. They will not be untruthful. They will not have any of the taints of the mind, the klishta manas manifestations. It won't have any of that, you see. It will be pure. It will be a pure life. That is all. But as long as we live, we have to make decisions. If you are driving a car and you want to go to Brighton, from here you don't get out of Hoddesdon and go northwards. Take the Great North Road. You make the right decision to go in the right direction, don't you? It's like that. See, I've always said one of the first rules of the spiritual life is never take leave of good sense. It's a very difficult thing to do, believe me. I know it. I find myself constantly taking leave of good sense. So there we are. You see, in the Upanishadic teachings, particularly in Upanishads like the Muktiko Upanishad. Muktiko Upanishad means the Upanishad which deals with liberation, mukti. The Pali Vimutti, you see. In the Muktiko Upanishad, it is clearly stated that our ordinary worldly habit of making plans, sankalpa, and going through a whole process of thinking things out, as we call it, is directed towards perpetuating selfness in oneself. And therefore, there is always impurity associated with it. If we can cease from this activity of sankalpa, then we have become free of it, at least one element in our lives, which one important element in our lives, which spoils life and which keeps us imprisoned in dukkha. You'll find that all the teachings move that way. In the Gita, you know, how Sri Krishna tells Arjuna, you'll find it in the 18th discourse, forsake all other things, come unto me. Me not meaning the another person, a perfected holy one called Krishna. This me is embodied in each and every human being. You know the words of Jesus, no man cometh unto the Father except through me. But what is this me that he refers to? What I am trying to drive at is, we must wake up to our inveterate habit when we think about these things, when we exercise our intellects, of transposing our situation, our conceptions and so on, onto the transcendent. You see? There have been several immigrations into India from very ancient days. As far as we know at present, and this is, I think, particularly Professor Hutton's view, the earliest immigrants into India were Negritos and Proto-Australoids. They entered approximately 8 or 9 thousand years ago. They developed a village culture, just clearing, making little clearings in what was a very fertile forest land in northern India. The Australoids must have been remarkably adventurous people because they spread right through the subcontinent, then through Burma and all that part of Asia, right down to Papua and New Guinea. So they must have made an extraordinary journey. And remember, those people just walked to get to where they had to go. They were not horsemen or any such thing. Now, they were a primitive people, and but they lived by the rule of law, the law of their own particular tribes as such. They believed in an indestructible life essence. And when a person died, they thought that that life essence went into the soil and emerged in trees or in plants or in animals. If a pregnant woman ate of that animal or plant, then that quickened the fetus within her, and a child was born, a living baby was the product of it. That was their belief. I'm just going to touch extremely briefly because there's a lot to talk about. This was their primitive belief, which laid the foundations for what ultimately turned out the doctrine of reincarnation as presented by the Brahmins in all the Vedic literature. Not all the Vedic literature, I'm sorry, but it comes in the Upanishads and later on, you see, that part of Vedic literature. After that, about 2,000 to 3,000 years passed by, and the civilizations which flourished in the Persian Gulf region, cities like Ur and Elam, Larsa, Lagash and so on, names to conjure with really, this, and particularly the Sumerians and the Armenians, They moved eastwards and came, crossed over the Hindu Kush mountains and through Balochistan and came into India. They were the great city builders. They had a developed material culture of their own, and the cities which they built, I think you have all heard of them, like Mohenjo-Daro and Harappa. All those cities were built by them. They had not only the developed material culture, but they had a considerable amount of art, music, mathematics, astronomy. These things were known to them. And they were skilled workmen in gold, silver, ivory, and so forth. Now, they had a pantheon of deities and spirits. They went eastwards into the Indus Valley and built these cities. Now, when Sir John Marshall was Director General of Archaeology in India in the early part of this century, he was responsible, he was the head who was responsible for excavating these cities, and they discovered some strange things. A king's palace was not so much in evidence, but a temple was, and a public bath. And the excavators were absolutely amazed at the skill of these people in city building, their knowledge how to build a city so that they had their streets going north and south and east and west, because they knew the direction of the prevailing winds, and if they built their cities that way, the winds would clean out the whole city, you see, and freshen the air. Also, they had indoor sanitation, baths, and all the rest of it in that culture. Then they spread southwards too. Southwards and a little bit eastwards through the Gangetic plain. On these people, they are descended the fair-skinned, very virile, haughty, vigorous, Aryan-speaking peoples who came from the Central Asian steppe lands in Professor Hutton's opinion, but in Professor Gordon Child's opinion, he spoke to me about this himself in 1944. According to his opinion, these Aryans came from the Ukraine, which when we say the Central Asian steppe lands, we must bear in mind that they are confined to the area a little bit east of the Caspian and southwards. That was the area, and they are semi-desert lands. They were semi-desert lands. And when they came armed with horse and the iron sword, because by that time the horse had been tamed, and it gave horsemen the advantage in battle over footmen. And the iron sword gave them a tremendous advantage over the bronze dagger and sword which people had in people were using in those days, in those early days, the Dravidian civilization as such. Now, these Aryan speaking peoples were very remarkable in certain ways. They were very good organizers, they were tolerant, and they were poets. They brought with them the Rig Veda, which means, really, that they must have had a remarkable spiritual development before they entered India. Because if you read the hymns of the Rig Veda, do not take any notice of what the scholars say about a polytheistic religion, and these were people who were just groping for spiritual truth by accident landed upon some beautiful sayings. The Rig Veda, all the hymns of the Rig Veda actually are the expressions of what those great mystics, by living the pure religious life, discovered about the nature of their development, the different states of consciousness, and they gave the names of the gods to all that. So they brought the Rig Veda with them. Now it's very interesting. There is no teaching at all about rebirth or reincarnation. No belief at all like that in the Rig Veda. If one lived a good life, one went to the happy place where the holy ones went, whatever that may mean. They give no description or interesting about it. But the hymns of the Rig Veda are the expressions by these great mystics of the profound realities of human development and fulfillment. The Aryan migrants, they established great kingdoms. So we get the three great stages stretching over a period of about 6,000 years of history. The village culture of the Negritos and Proto-Australoids, the city-states, and there were advanced city-states of the Sumerians and Armenians. The Armenians were brachycephalic, broad-headed. That means the measurement from here to here was more than 75% and more from there to there. And the Sumerians were dolichocephalic, which means that this measurement had a greater proportion than that measurement. Now, after they had established kingdoms, remember the Aryans were in a minority. The conquered people were in the majority. And those whom they conquered were naturally had the position of serfs rather than citizens with equal rights with the Aryans. And naturally they started asking questions. But before that, The capable ones amongst the established people there before the Aryans came, they were far more intelligent in many ways, especially in worldly ways. They approached their Aryan overlords, talked with them, and evolved a Brahmin caste. The Aryans themselves as such had only three main groups: the rulers, the ruling caste group, those who did the trade and all that kind of thing, and those who did all the menial services. They had only three castes like that. But the Dravidians interacting with these Aryans gave rise to a Brahmin caste. And when those who were depressed and conquered asked questions, why and how is it that you are overlords and enjoying status and a happy life and all the rest of it, and we are drawers of water and hewers of wood? Now, both the clever Dravidians and the Aryan-speaking people hit upon the idea of taking the belief, the primitive belief of the proto-Australoids about the life essence going into the soil and coming out in new human beings. And so they dished out the idea of rebirth, of reincarnation as such, and of karma at the same time. This is how it happened. Most people don't know this, and they have never looked into it carefully. The result was that they said to the conquered peoples, look, you in your past life made mistakes, and so now you have to be a serf. And if you live well and cooperate with the rulers of the kingdom, then you will have a better life next time. They found that little ruse very effective, and the people followed it. The Rig Veda had one hymn, particularly one hymn, which was not disclosed to the masses. The 90th hymn of the 10th book of the Rig Veda, in verse 12, gives out this secret, which of course was a poetic expression by the Holy Ones to suggest the complete unity and inherent divinity of all human beings. It was the verse which said that the Brahman came out of the mouth of Brahma, the Vaishya, the merchant class and so on, came out of the belly of the warrior caste meant not only warriors but administrators and so on, and judge and those who worked where justice was concerned and all that. The Kshatriya caste came out of the shoulders and the arms of Brahma. The Vaishya caste came out of his tummy, and the Shudras came out of his feet. But they said, we are all part of Brahma himself, you see. And if we all do our duty as laid down in the rules which had through the centuries grown up, because remember, all these bits of history take thousands of years. If you cooperate and fulfill your duty, then you will in your next life be in a much better position altogether, and you will reap great happiness and so on. Well, they found that it worked. It was pragmatic. Yes, right. So this belief in being born again. Remember that the word used there was punarjanma. Punarjanma. Janma means birth. Punar means again. You see? Punarjanma. It wasn't the Buddhist punabhava. The Buddha never uses punarjanma. Janma. He always says punabhava. Do bear that in mind. Again becoming. But that again becoming has been presented by most scholars and by sort of general popular belief as the same as punarjanma. It is not the same as punarjanma. Do bear that in mind. Now, with the growth of the kingdoms and the Aryan people and the Brahmins and so forth, they were practicing yoga. Yoga was known in the to the Persian Gulf people, and when they built their cities, they made lovely little things carved on the semi-precious stone and stones and so forth, the Bitilic stones as they are called. And one of them, there were only three such specimens which Sir John Marshall and his group were able to dig up, had the carving of a horned god in a meditative pose. In a yogic pose. Now this is of tremendous importance, and Sir John Marshall identified that the carving with a carving of the third person of the Hindu Trinity, the god Shiva. You see? Now what is the significance of this? Mind you, it's 3000 BC. means that for 5,000 years at least, yoga and the deep states of consciousness which can be entered into through the true yoga. The true yoga is not only the asanas and pranayama, but it is the moral development, the yamas, and the religious practices, the niyamas, and then the dharana, pratyahara. The pratyahara, they say, is the withdrawal of the senses from the objects of sense. I don't think that's a good translation. Pratyahara in actual practice really means becoming free of attachment and from aversion through your response to all the stimuli that come to you. And you'll find that through the great scriptures, that point is very, very strongly emphasized, to become free of attachment on the one hand and aversion on the other hand. Pratyahara was followed by dharana, dhyana and samadhi, the supreme final communion state. Now this had developed, and of course it has come out most of all and pretty fully in the Upanishads. The major Upanishads sort of give the sort of philosophical presentation of it. The identity of Brahman and Atma, and these people, were these perfected holy ones, spoke of realized transcendence when they spoke about Brahman and Atma. They spoke about realized transcendence. So that they scaled the heights and plumbed the depths of the religious life completely, as far as it was possible for any human being to do so. And what they put out in the Upanishads, in certain respects, has never been surpassed. When the Buddha flourished, and he flourished approximately 1,000 years after the days of the Rig Veda and the early pre-Buddhistic Upanishads, he specially emphasized one aspect only, because he found that all this knowledge of the Upanishads was becoming a matter for intellectual obtaining intellectual pleasure with their discussions and so forth, and it led nowhere as far as the goodness and purity of life was concerned. I mentioned, was it yesterday or day before, that if you look through the Anguttara Nikaya, the first volume, and in the Majjhima also, first volume, the Buddha speaks of the terrible punishments and cruelties that were inflicted. Now, if that was the case, the people must have been extraordinarily evil in as far as true civilization was concerned. So he devoted all his energy. He said, put aside all this metaphysical discussion and so forth, and live the good life. He devoted himself entirely to that, and he refused to discuss things which were transcendent. But he did affirm, particularly in the Brahmajala Sutta, he affirmed that he knew these things, and he called them sweet, delightful, beyond dialectic and reason. Ordinary, that is to say, the ordinary logical reasoning that we exercise, beyond all that, see. But he never spoke about it, apart from just occasionally saying a word or two about nirvana, or when he made the pronouncement of the unborn, unbecome, unmade, and so forth, you see. And when he used that magical phrase of his, vinyanam anidassanam anantam sabbato pavam. Well, that phrase is the Buddha's equivalent of what in the pre-Buddhistic Upanishads is applied to the Atma. Now, the doctrine of the Atma, of course, had become spoilt. The masses began to talk in terms of my Atma and your Atma, which is, of course, impossible and absurd. They believe that it is my Atma which, after the death of this organism, incarnates, has a punarjanma in another vehicle as such. Also, in the Gita, when these words are put into the mouth of Sri Krishna by the author of the Gita, the Blessed Lord said, Arjuna asks, later was thy birth, earlier the birth of Vivasvan. How then am I to understand that thou declaredst it in the beginning, that is, before he was born? And Krishna says, many births have been left behind by me and by thee, O Arjuna. I know them all, but thou knowest not thine, O Parantapa. Many births in this case is said by him who had become the all. In mind and consciousness he had Krishna Dvaipayana Veda Vyasa, the author of the Gita, had realized that supreme state. And in that supreme state, when you say I, you mean actually everything, everybody that exists. And so there is an identification with those who went before, those who are to come, and those who are living now, you see. But of course the whole Hindu world takes it to mean that Sri Krishna affirmed reincarnation. Now, there are certain other things which Sri Krishna said which are of very great importance. He said, I am the abode of Brahman, the immortal and imperishable. And he also says that his abode is the imperishable. So how can for us as we are, it sounds totally illogical. How can I be the abode of the imperishable and also say that the imperishable is my abode? It's like saying that my house and I are one and the same. My house abides in me and I abide in my house. That's what it comes to, doesn't it? But listen to this. Krishna says in the ninth discourse, I am life immortal and also death. Being and non-being am I. In the tenth discourse he says, all-consuming death am I, and the source of all things to come. Now consider this, let us consider this very carefully. I am life immortal and also death. Being and non-being am I. Now we know that all beings are, as we experience them through our sense perceptions, they are all separate individuals as such. These are beings. I am a being, you are a being, and so forth. Now, beings are innumerable. What about non-being? When this thing dies, it is completely integrated into the non-being. The non-being is unitary, it's one only. Beings are innumerable. So, beings go out of the context of the particular finite, temporal and mortal into the transcendent context of the infinite, eternal and immortal. Non-being is infinite. And when being dies and is integrated into non-being, it completely loses its separate identity. I think I mentioned the other day that we are like rivers. The sun's heat evaporates the water from the oceans, rain falls, and innumerable rivers come into being. All right? And these rivers ultimately end, if they don't end in a desert, they ultimately end in the ocean. And they lose their identity. Completely lose their identity. Now this idea that one's identity is completely lost is very repugnant to most human beings. We absolutely cling to our grand egos. We absolutely cling to this ego. We'll give up heaven for the sake of having ego and all the misfortunes consequent upon it. That is what we are like, you see. So now, Krishna says, being and non-being am I. And if we can really understand this, we will see the significance of the other statement, all-consuming death am I, and the source of all to come. That means that out of non-being, which belongs to the context of the eternal, and the infinite, it presses out of itself various beings. What causes this expression as such? We can look at it in two ways. One is this, the direct way that the absolute creative energy just expresses all things and all people, all living creatures and so forth. All right, that is one way of looking at it. But what happens? All that I have felt, thought, done makes a certain impress upon the transcendent context. And the effects of that are devoid of any identifiable entity. All that no longer bears my label, Firoz Mehta, attached to the deeds and thoughts and feelings and so forth. It becomes integrated into something which is a single unitary whole, a totality. And when that creative power again expresses individuals, that new individual has the influence of what was integrated into the totality. That's one way of looking at it. There is another way. You know how the Buddha talked of the different khandhas and the aggregates. And I quoted the Visuddhimagga, Buddha Ghosha's Visuddhimagga, in which it is said that I better read it to you again. When a man is confused about death, instead of taking death thus, death in every case is a breakup of aggregates. He figures that it is a lasting being that dies, that it is a lasting being's transmigration to another incarnation, and so on. When he is confused about reappearance, instead of taking rebirth thus, birth in every case is a manifestation of aggregates. He figures that it is a lasting being's manifestation in a new body. Now, it is a little bit simpler if we consider it from this point of view. When I die, when this fellow dies, all the aggregates, the rupa, vedna, sanya, sankara, vijnana, are completely gone. They are completely gone. They are integrated into the general mass. The body, as you know, all the atoms which compose the body, the carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, sulfur, phosphorus, the whole lot of them, they go back into the universal stock of carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, and so on, you see. Similarly, the Vedana goes back into the general stock of that aggregate. Sanya, Sankara, Vijnana do the same. They go into the general stock. And once they go into the general stock, you see, the identifiable entity, Firoz Mehta, who subsists simply because this particular lot of Khandas composes him, that identity is gone, completely gone with it in the general stock. But it influences the general stock. So when out of the general stock a new conglomeration of khandas comes into being, you have a totally new person, really. Each of us just influences the source from which beings, innumerable beings, are expressed. Do you get the idea? You see? Now, this is not reincarnation or rebirth, because when we talk about reincarnation and rebirth, we are thinking of ourselves as an identifiable entity. We always say, oh, I am I and not you, which is, of course, in a pragmatic sense, perfectly obvious as far as objects and bodies go, that we are not the other fellow. Otherwise, there'd be confusion, worse confounded. But this I am I consciousness is just a thought without any substance to it whatsoever. It's just a string of words. How does this I am I consciousness come up? When I am born, I have no self-consciousness at all, that I am I. Gradually, as the months pass by, because of my interaction with my parents and those around me and so forth, and the idea I, and the idea you, and the idea he, she, etc., comes into being. All those ideas come into being. But at the death of this, it completely disappears. Think for a moment. Even in sleep, when you are in profound slumber, you don't know that you are you. Do you? You don't know that you are you. You are completely blotto. If mere sleep can do that, or an anesthetic can do that, you see, this I am I consciousness is utterly gone under that. It comes into being again after you've come out of your anesthesia, and when you wake up in the morning or whatever time you wake up from sleep, you recollect. This I am I idea, you see, and cling to it. If mere sleep or an anesthetic can deprive you of the I am I consciousness, what substantiality, what permanency has that I am I consciousness? None whatsoever. None whatsoever. And when you die, when the khandas are gone, then for the last time the I am I consciousness is completely gone. The identifiable entity aspect is completely gone. This is the important point to bear in mind. I know that lots of researches are made, experiments have been made, for example, patients under hypnosis and all the rest of it, and they are supposed to recollect this, that and the other, and they say that they go back into the past and recollect their past lives. But do remember this. Already in the person who is examining the patient under hypnosis, and the hypnotized person himself has the knowledge and idea of rebirth and reincarnation present, which exercises a great influence in saying that, oh yes, I went back into the past. I can't see that. I just don't see it that way at all. I see that there is the complete cessation. And the Buddha was quite right when he said that all the five khandas completely disappear. They are completely perishing. Don't grasp them. That is not the self of me. Na me so atta. He says very distinctly, that is not the self of me. The implication of the Buddha statement that there is a reality to self in the sense of the ultimate, the Atma. Atta is the Pali form of Atma. Now, I think I said at our previous meetings that which is universal which is the ultimate reality and so forth, functions through you all the time permanently. Pure mind, the absolute consciousness, the creative energy, etc., the Atma or Brahman, we'll call it whatever you like, is functioning through each one of us all the time. You see? But there is nothing appropriatable by the perishing khandhas as its own, which remains its gives it a permanent proprietary right over a bit of that which is infinite and eternal. That is why I reject the popular picture altogether. Now, I have never denied that there is an underlying reality which brought into being this this particular misleading and inadequate picture called reincarnation or rebirth. There is an underlying reality. What happens when you enter the deepest state? The state which the Buddha called the cessation of perception and feeling, the ninth stage from after the four jhanas and the four samapattis. You are completely in tune with the infinite. You are vibrating in harmony with the absolute, you see. And I mentioned that this functions with extraordinary rapidity. And yesterday, I think, I read a little bit of this passage to you, that in the cessation of perception and feeling, you are in rhythm with the creative pulse, the discontinuous throb, which is life, other life. The Kabbalah called it the life-death pulse. But I feel that that is not a very adequate word to use, death, in this context. It is, that's why I call it a life, other life pulse. Because the word death, at the back of our minds, deep down in our minds, has the idea, has the feeling of annihilation. It's the end, the finish of it all, you see. And so we postulate an immortal soul which will go upstairs or downstairs according to how we have lived and so forth. But if we say life, other life, we will be able to get a less inadequate idea of it. The creation is new, not a reformulation or modification of the old. The creative pulse is non-repetitive. It has no continuity in our meaning of the word. And then you remember I read, how is it then that in everyday life most things stay put? And the point is that our consciousness is so sluggish that we cannot sort of, we feel that it is a continuity. Just like if you, any doctors, oh yes, we have a doctor here, if at least one doctor. If you get two pinpricks sufficiently close to each other, you record it as only a single prick and not two pin pricks. Or if you take a wire or something, and at the end of it you have something which is burning, and you can twirl it round fast enough, the impression of the onlooker is, oh, there is a circle of fire, whereas you know that it is just one little thing at the end burning, and because of that movement it appears as a circle. Now, the holy ones in the state of the supreme communion in the ultimate enstasy possible. I use the word enstasy and not ecstasy for a very good reason. Enstasy supervenes when you go within, inwards. Ecstasy can take place when you move outwards and you are outside yourself. An ecstatic state is a state in which you are outside yourself. But the Buddha was very keen upon being perfectly poised, perfectly self-contained. in the true sense of the word self-contained. So now, the Holy Ones in the state of the Supreme Communion, in the ultimate ecstasy possible to man, found it so difficult to convey this adequately in olden days, to convey it in concepts and words. Today it is a little easier. Why? The advance in science and mathematics enables the mind to feel and to understand the difference between transformation of the old material and transmutation into the entirely new. The former is a manipulation or modification. The latter, transmutation, is a creation. The former can be associated with causality, time, and continuity. The latter is acausal, timeless, and discontinuous. This is a very important point to bear in mind. In attempting to convey the experience in transcendent awareness of this creative pulse of life, other life, in the forms of thought and speech in those days, there emerged the whole complex of ideas classed under karma, as it is popularly understood, that is, causality, retribution, reward, purgatory, hell, heaven, and the endless toil and moil of progress in space and time. And under rebirth, variously termed reincarnation, transmigration, metempsychosis, metensomatosis, and palingenesis. The whole complex, if you examine it carefully, is ego-centered and revolves around the assumption of a permanent entity or immortal soul. Such doctrines and dogmas may have use in consoling the hurt heart or in encouraging the muddled mind to keep going a little longer. But their ethical and practical consequences have obstructed man's flowering. It is necessary to be open-minded, to learn afresh, to put aside with right wisdom, as the Buddha said, all that needs to be put aside. Freedom from all grasping is deathlessness. Now, in that supreme meditative state, the one and only self, if you like, the Atma. Self is rather a poor word to use, to tell you the truth. The English word self has a very simple, straightforward, distinct meaning. It means this psychophysical organism. This is me, as we say, you see, and that is you, and so on. Self has that meaning. But the scholars from the last century and even before that onwards, they took to translating Atma as self. It is not that at all. So you see, this transcendent reality, this total reality, functions continuously and entirely through each finite mortal creation. That's the marvel of our existence. If that were not the case, as the Buddha pointed out, there'd be no release from this here, which is the perishing and the mortal and the and dukkha, into the nirvanic state. So, you will, I trust, understand why I reject the popular presentations under the names of rebirth and reincarnation. There is a continuous influence which every one of us exercises. We are the product of that kind of influence which all the people before us exercised upon the mass of khandhas, if you like to look at it that way, or directly upon the context of the infinite, eternal, and the immortal. And I can assure you, as far as I am concerned, there's an extraordinary freedom and a sense of calm and clarity by being free of this idea of many, many lives. And see the absurdities which have been put forward by so many speakers, Buddhist, Jain, Hindu, all of them. They talk in terms of hundreds of thousands of lives. If you allow even 30 years as the average span, it won't work. The human race has been on the globe just about 3 or 4 million years. The human race as we are has been about 3 or 4 million years. And if you had 1 million incarnations, 30 million years, you're going back to the primordial common ancestor of the apes and ourselves.